Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White, and our big conversation on Insight this morning will center around a shifting 2020 census count timeline. A federal judge says it can extend to the end of October, but despite that, the Trump administration says it'll end early. We'll hear from experts who explain why the count is important to California, its cities, Latinos, and other groups. Also, where the count deadline stands as the clock keeps ticking. But first, tonight, here on CAP Radio, you will hear the first presidential debate between President Donald Trump and Democratic nominee Joe Biden. You can also watch it at capradio.org if those plans aren't locked in for you yet. Stated topics to be asked by moderator Chris Wallace of Fox News Sunday include the Supreme Court, racial justice, the COVID-19 pandemic, and the integrity of the presidential race itself. So to get some perspective on what's expected tonight and what it all means for the outcome of this year's race, we lean on a longtime friend of the show, political junkie Ken Rudin, who's the host of the Political Junkie podcast. Ken, nice to speak with you again.
Thank you, Randall. Good morning.
So I'm curious, what are you watching for tonight? Are you going into it with a specific focus?
I am going into it with tremendous fear and trepidation. I've been a veteran of watching debates going back at least to 1976 between Ford and Carter. And, you know, back then, Ford and Carter, Reagan Mondale, Reagan Carter, there was Nixon Kennedy in 1960. There was always a normal civil discussion about the issues. Quemoy and Matsu, you remember that in 1960? Well, but now it's Donald Trump. He's unpredictable. He's unhinged sometimes. We saw in 2016 that he did things in the debate with Hillary Clinton that no presidential candidate has ever done or tried to do. And he gets away with it because he is Donald Trump. So I think most of the pressure is really going to be on Joe Biden today. He has an ostensible lead nationally. I don't know how true that is, but at least the numbers indicate that. And he's leading in some key battleground states as well. So almost, you know, when Donald Trump has nothing to lose, you know, hide under the bed because you know that haymakers are going to come. And just Joe Biden has to be prepared for whatever's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. So Joe Biden certainly goes into the debates with more of a lead in terms of the polls. But who's expected to do better in the debate? The person who goes in with people expecting more sometimes can lose more because they don't fare as well as they were expected to.
That's very true. I think about the vice presidential debate between Joe Biden and Sarah Palin in 2008. The fact that Sarah Palin did far better than anybody expected, a lot of people thought she did okay. But it's hard to quantify how people see debates. I think to a person, almost everyone looked at 2016 and thought that Hillary Clinton bested Donald Trump on the issues, on the debating style, on the points and all that. But there was something about Trump that energized people who said, well, you know something, he's not politics as usual. I like his irreverence and I may even vote for him, even though most people, who, including myself, thought that Hillary Clinton clearly was the winner. Let me just give you one more historical thing. In 1984, the first debate between Reagan and Mondale did very, very well. A lot of people thought that maybe the race was turning. But in the second debate, Reagan had this famous line, I'm not going to make my opponent's age and youth and inexperience an issue. And everybody laughed and they said, oh my goodness, that gave Reagan the debate. But if you remember, people forget this, but at the end of the second debate, Reagan was wandering and he's talking about driving down the California coast and talking about putting a letter in a time capsule. And I was saying, my goodness, he's losing it right before our eyes. So I kind of thought that Reagan did not do great in that 84 debate, but that great line that my opponent's youth and inexperience won the day. And a lot of people could be swayed by a telling moment or a memorable line.
And President Reagan had a lot of those. He was able to lean on his gift of gab quite a bit.
Well, not only gift of gab, he was an actor. And I'm not saying that to put him down. I mean, he had 8 years as governor of California, so he did have a record to defend. But the fact is that he was a very good debater. Even the "there you go again" when he said that to Jimmy Carter in 1980. I mean, I love to see how many times Joe Biden tonight said "there you go again," because you know he's going to hear a lot of things from Donald Trump that is plainly not true.
You mentioned that in 2016, voters gravitated toward that X factor that the president had going in, which was he wasn't part of the Washington establishment. He was something different. He was breaking up the norm. This time around, he goes in as part of the Washington establishment, yet he still doesn't follow the norms. In a year, 2020, that has been so unusual and so different, might people be looking for a little more of the norm and not willing to sort of roll the dice with something risky?
Randall, that's a very, very important point. I don't know if Donald Trump is going to lose any supporters by his debate performance, but the fact is, you have 206,000 Americans who have died of the COVID virus. 7 million have been tested positive. This is under President Trump's watch. You have an economy that is, millions and millions are unemployed. Dr. Fauci says that more people are going to be infected, that they think that the cooler fall is going to lead to an increase in infections and death. This is under President Trump's watch. So you could do all you want to say, all the crazy things you want to say, that Joe Biden needs a mental test to take, an IQ test or something. No, I'm sorry. He needs to take a drug test, he said. A drug test. All the things he wants to say that'll be distracting. But I think the big difference, as you point out, Randall, is that this year he has a record to defend. And in many cases, the record leaves Americans, a lot of Americans, wanting.
And you mentioned the pandemic. That is going to be one of the topics that moderator Chris Wallace has already mentioned he will bring up. Polling shows the president doesn't do so well when the pandemic is the focus for people.
Well, nor should it be. I mean, look, if he said, for example, months after the CDC and Dr. Fauci and others have said wearing a mask will make a big difference, the president insisted that it's not true. You don't have to wear a mask. You could drink hydroxychloroquine, all the things that he's come up with. And thousands and thousands and thousands of Americans have died. The president will say, well, I stopped the influx from China back in February. And yes, he did. But all the other things that people warned about, again, the safe distance between people, wearing a mask. To this day, the president is still having rallies with people who are not wearing masks. And Fauci and others say that short of a vaccine, and by the way, that vaccine is not coming anytime soon, even though the president has suggested it will, short of a vaccine, a mask is the best way to ward off this virus. And the president still scoffs at it, although he does wear a mask more often than he did in the past.
Yeah, he got into it with the CDC director, the CDC director said that it would be available in late second quarter or the third quarter of 2021. And that same day, the president came out and said, I don't know what he's talking about. That's wrong. We're going to have it by November.
And look what he said about the CDC. He says basically he's put political pressure. The White House has put political pressure on the CDC to downplay the effects of the pandemic, say that the kids are really not at risk of getting it, that it really is. We really are turning the corner and it will get better if not just go away sooner than later, which is the complete opposite of what Dr. Fauci is saying we're in for a very tough fall and winter.
So how could the president attack the challenger, former Vice President Joe Biden, when it comes to the pandemic? What do you expect to hear from the president on that?
Well, he'll say that Joe Biden and many Democrats said you didn't need a mask in the very beginning. That may have been true on February 1st. It certainly wasn't true March 1st and April 1st and months after that. But being beyond the pandemic, he wants to get under Joe Biden's skin. We've seen in the past that Joe Biden has a tendency to blow up. He does have a temper. Now, again, he does have a way of smiling to alleviate a pressure, things like that. But if he talks about Hunter Biden, which you know he will, if he'll talk about Tara Reid, the woman who accused him of sexual inappropriate behavior, I mean, he just does that to goad people and get under his skin. It's up to Joe Biden to respond and how he needs to respond. Does he go toe to toe? Does he say, well, yeah, what about the $130,000 to Stormy Daniels? Or does he say, that's not what the American people care about. They care about improving the economy, getting rid of, stopping this virus, and basically reversing of what President Trump has put into action.
We also know that racial equity will be a topic for discussion. Who holds the cards there?
It's a good question. It's a serious question, because one would think that, you know, in the aftermath of George Floyd's killing, you could say that, well, Joe Biden would talk about systemic racism and police brutality and how driving while black is not just a just an empty expression. It's a serious occurrence with how the police treat people of color. But President Trump is going to focus on the resulting violence in the cities, saying that the Antifa and the left-wing mobs are going to taking over the city, and the suburbs need to be worried because there's going to be an influx of low-cost housing in their neighborhoods, and crime is going to be up. He's playing the law and order card that was effective for Richard Nixon and perhaps George Wallace in 1968. But it's a different America. It's different demographics in 2020. I'm not sure how well that plays.
They're going to talk about the integrity of the race itself, which has been called into question by the president, who has indicated that he may, if he loses the election, there may not be a peaceful transfer of power.
That has to be highlight on Joe Biden's list of things to talk about. The fact that the president of the United States says he cannot commit, won't commit to a peaceful transfer of power is unprecedented in annals of American history. And I mean, and he'll say, the president will say, well, there's all these ballots that are being sent in. There's no accounting for it. It could lead to fraud. The history of ballots that have been tainted by fraud is just minuscule compared to the amount of ballots that have been sent. But Trump is saying over and over again that Biden is allowing these unchecked, unfiltered ballots to influence the election. But my goodness, I mean, what they're talking about by closing down polling places, by limiting the number of polling places, by shutting down hours, by putting restrictions in front of people, voter suppression and things like that is a key issue that I think Joe Biden needs to focus on and let people know that he will fight for the integrity of democracy, which the president may not be willing to do.
There's nothing to indicate from the moderator that the New York Times piece on the president's tax returns will be part of the discussion. But might Joe Biden find a way to work that in?
Well, I mean, one of the subjects that Chris Wallace talked about will be the Trump and Biden records. And of course, if Trump has paid $750 in federal income taxes, and as Joe Biden has said in the last few days, that doesn't even compare it to what nurses and firefighters and teachers have paid. I can't possibly see Joe Biden breaking ground by having that subject. It's not what Chris Wallace may want, but of course, once it's in the front pages of the newspapers everywhere around the country, he'd be very foolish to not talk about it.
This is the first of three debates, Ken. I would imagine the ordering of the debates is more important this time because people are already voting.
Yes, that's very true. And I think that's what that's why President Trump wanted a fourth debate. He thought this was not fair, that, you know, he needs, the American people need to see the debates before they vote. But I also, and I think the history shows that more people watch the first debate than the other debate. So obviously tonight is very consequential. But as I pointed out before, in Reagan Mondale in 1984, and even Obama Romney in 2012, the first debate, the challengers did really well. Mondale did very well. Romney did very well in the first debates. The second debate, the incumbent presidents, Reagan and Obama, regained their footing. So don't, let's not decide. First of all, I wish everybody will turn off their TV and radio after the debates. Make your own decision. Don't let pundits decide, tell you who won and who lost.
Yeah, wait till tomorrow morning to hear it from Ken.
Well, that's important too.
Right?
No, but at least give yourself a few hours to let it stew. But you know that whatever you think about the first debate, that may not hold true for subsequent debates.
All right. Ken Rudin is a longtime political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. He will be back here tomorrow morning to talk about what we've all heard on the debates or watched via capradio.org. Ken, thank you as always. Look forward to speaking with you tomorrow.
Randall, thanks a lot. I hope everybody watches the debate tonight.
All right. Up next, we'll dive into the 2020 census count and the conflict surrounding its shifting timeline. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. And our big conversation this morning is the 2020 census and how the court is faring under challenging conditions. So a federal judge ruled last week the U.S. Census count can continue through the October 31st deadline due to the pandemic, blocking the Trump administration's plan to end it a month early. But then just yesterday, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross tweeted the 2020 census count will end early on October 5th, despite the ruling. The once-in-a-decade count is proceeding during a pandemic and historic wildfires here in the West, with unprecedented presidential involvement and legal challenges. What's at stake is consequential. The count determines congressional representation and how $1.5 trillion in federal funding is distributed, money that pandemic-ravaged cities desperately need at this point. Joining us now with the latest on the 2020 census and why it matters so much here in California, Nevada, is KPCC and LAist census reporter Caroline Champlin. Welcome to Insight, Caroline.
Hey, good morning. How you doing?
Terrific. So Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross tweeted yesterday that the census count will end on October 5th, despite the federal judge's ruling. What do we know about that?
Right. So the Census Bureau hasn't released any more info besides that tweet and that press release, which said essentially the same thing. But at a court hearing yesterday with this federal district judge who's been overseeing the census case, she asked them why this date was chosen. And a lawyer for the government basically just said the situation is constantly changing and they are updating these timelines on a daily basis. And he actually acknowledged that it could still change. And according to my count, this is now the fourth time the census deadline has changed. So I'll just put it out there that I wouldn't get too fixated on this date yet, because it could change again. And even the Census Bureau has said it could change. And that judge has requested more information on how that date was chosen. That's supposed to be released by Department of Justice lawyers by 10 a.m. this morning. So we should have more information soon.
Yeah, Caroline, initially the census was scheduled to end back in October. That was before there was a pandemic or anything, right?
before there was a pandemic, it was actually supposed to end in July.
In July.
And then once the so way back, a while back. But then the COVID-19 plan, it was supposed to end. Yeah, exactly what you said, October 31st.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about the federal judge, what the federal judge ruled last week. Why did she choose to allow the count to continue?
Right. So she said the case is tipping in the plaintiff's favor. And that's why she ruled on this, released this preliminary injunction. Mm. And basically what the plaintiffs have argued is that there's no good reason for changing the deadline and making this an earlier deadline. And she says so far, it looks like that might be true, that the Census Bureau hasn't given a good explanation. And she said if she hadn't released this preliminary injunction, it's likely that irreparable harm could have been caused by a shortened count. And that would be in terms of a census undercount, most likely. That would mean lost funding and lost political representation in the country and especially in the state.
Mm-hmm. Does 1 month make that big of a difference?
It might. That's a good question, because it's a challenging point where a lot of census advocates are actually burned out and out of money to do this work. But the Census Bureau, what they could do is do more follow-ups and make more attempts at certain houses where people haven't responded, instead of just relying on a proxy attempt, which is when they just ask your neighbor for your information instead. And that's obviously less ideal. So if they have more time, they could be making more attempts. They could be doing spot checks where they just, you know, check back in at someone who's already responded and just make sure that person has been counted. So this could lead to better quality control, but we'll just have to see how long it lasts. And the Census Bureau hasn't said exactly how they plan to comply and how they plan to change their outreach tactics.
Caroline, a couple of cities at least, Los Angeles down where you are, and Salinas on the Central Coast, have challenged the shortened census. What's their grounds?
Right. So both of these cities have a really big hard to count population. So those are people that for whatever reason, it's hard for a census taker to get to. It could mean like literal physical barriers like this. They live, you know, in a unit that's sort of hidden behind another house. Or it could mean that they have, you know, they have gates around them, or they have, you know, or it could be like they just don't feel comfortable responding to the census, or they don't have English language skills. Mm-hmm. So all of these barriers sort of overlap. And because the population in LA is so big, this becomes a really big problem. And actually over half of the city, half of the residents are estimated to be hard to count. And that's the same in Salinas. So when there's a undercount, it's these communities that are the most likely to be missed. And so these cities have sort of the biggest risk for an undercount.
Do we have any insight into why the Trump administration would want to cut the census short and not get as full a count as possible?
All right. So there's a Census Bureau line on this. And what they have said is that they are just trying to follow the law, which does say that, you know, population counts and the population, the census data is all supposed to be crunched by the end of the year and then delivered to the president. And they're just trying to get that done on time, they're saying. But what the plaintiffs have argued is they think that the Trump administration is trying to hurry this up and trying to have all the data finished because they want to ensure that Trump is still in office and able to oversee this data and potentially remove undocumented immigrants from the data, which is something that he said that he wants to do. Mm-hmm. And if the census were to get delayed, that would get pushed most likely to April of next year. And there's a chance that President Trump wouldn't be able to have any control over that data.
Mm-hmm. And here in California, we have wildfires like we've never seen before in recorded history anyway. And of course, we've got pandemic strapped cities. So we've never had a situation like this where we're trying to conduct a census at the same time. So is there an argument to be made by cities there that, hey, we need to make sure everybody's counted because we're spending more and taking in less during this pandemic, and it's far more difficult for us to get out?
Oh yeah, they've certainly made that argument. I think that's sort of one of the core arguments of the census case that the city of LA is involved in. And like you said at the beginning, $1.5 trillion is allocated by the census across the nation, and that's per year. And California receives billions of dollars of that. And mostly it's for Medi-Cal, for health insurance, but it also goes to education programs, for school lunches and Title I grants. And if cities are already working through the fallout of COVID-19, the fallout of wildfires, maybe, it wouldn't be ideal to also have federal funding cut on top of those existing pressures. And then that's going to last for a decade. Let me just remind everybody right. that the census determines funding for a decade, which is a very long time to have less money.
Yeah. And a trillion is what, 1,000 billion, right? So, I mean, we're talking about a lot of money.
It is. It's so hard to wrap your head around.
It really is. Caroline Champlin is a census reporter for KPCC, our fellow NPR member station down in the LA region, Pasadena to be exact, and LAist, which great articles on LAist. I love hopping onto that website. Thanks for joining us today, Caroline.
Thank you so much. Great being here.
People of Spanish or Hispanic origin were listed as white when it came to the question of race in the U.S. Census prior to 1970. Then a decade later, 14.6 million U.S. residents self-identified as Latino. This year, the number is expected to exceed 60 million, and advocacy groups are concerned the challenges facing the census that we just discussed could result in the worst undercount of Black and Latino populations in three decades. Laura Gomez is a professor of law and faculty director of UCLA's Critical Race Studies Program in She joins us now. Welcome, Laura. Great to have you here.
Nice to be here, Randall. Thank you.
So help us understand the significance of the 2020 census for Latinos.
Absolutely. Let me start by going back to something that Carolyn was talking about, which is when you asked a question about does the census, you know, what are the effects of actually cutting this time
by a month.
By a month. And actually, Judge Koh was very clear about that. She said the data showed from the GAO, from the Census Scientific Advisory Board, and from the Inspector General of the Commerce Department, they all agreed that actually it would be devastating for an accurate count. So the record is very strong. And when this goes up on an appeal, I don't see any chance of a different outcome. Mm-hmm. So I just want to put that out there that this October 5th thing, that's not going to fly.
And the GAO is the General Accounting Office?
I think it's the General Accountability Office.
Uh-huh.
So that made me think back to my time on Capitol Hill, which was like 40 years ago, Randall.
Okay.
So, you know, I may be wrong on that, too.
Uh-huh.
So where do Latinos fit in all this? And I guess what I'd like to do is let's kind of take a bigger portrait, both bigger in terms of time and in terms of the national perspective. Is if we look at Trump's candidacy for president the first time and his policies in office, what we see are repeated attempts to depress the count of Latinos, right? And so this happened when he wanted to add the citizenship question, right? And mm-hmm. the Supreme Court said no. It happened when he decided he ignored census advice about adding a Latino category on the race question and doing away with the Hispanic ethnicity question. It happened recently when he said, I'm not going to include undocumented people. Not all undocumented people are Latino, but a good chunk of them are. And it is happening right now when he talks about wanting to depress the overall count.
And the Constitution's very clear on the fact that just everybody that's here needs to be counted regardless of status, correct?
Exactly. And let's keep in mind that that wasn't always the case. It was the case since after the Civil War, when we added the Equal Protection Clause, that the Three-Fifths Clause went away, right? And so that is what's at stake here is really, and I think it's very apropos that we link what's going on with Latinos now back to what was happening with Blacks in the original Constitution being counted as three-fifths of a person for the apportionment process.
And Laura, you were dead on. It's the Government Accountability Office. Thank you to this tool called Google. I was able to pull it up. But
You're very adept.
No, you were spot on. So thank you for that. What are the trends in California showing for the Latino population?
Well, we are a huge chunk of the population, right? So about 40% of the overall population of the state. And of course, we're the largest state. Mm-hmm. Also, there's a huge population of people in California living in mixed status families, meaning that at least one member of the family, it's usually one of the parents, is without authorization to be in the country, but the others are US citizens. And California has there's 17 million people in the nation overall, and California has the largest chunk. So those people are particularly going to be deterred from participating in the census. And that's why we need this extra time to have people actually out there letting them know that it's safe to participate.
Are there areas in the state that are seeing more growth with Latino populations or some areas where we're seeing, a loss?
I don't know the details on that particular question, but I do think that one thing that's important to keep in mind right now, and we've seen this with the pandemic, is that Southern California is much more heavily Latino than Northern California. And yet the balance of power, political power in the state, tends to be in the North where you are, right? Not only the capital, but also just, if we look at voter turnout and things like that, because we know that voter turnout correlates with age and with wealth and things like that, right? So we're and we know that
both sitting U.S.
County.
Oh, I'm sorry. Both sitting U.S. senators from California are from the Bay Area.
Exactly. Exactly. So
and governor.
That may soon change if we have in 35 days, if we have a particular outcome, we may have an appointee who's from Southern California.
It seems to be pointing that way for who the appointee would be.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
How about other minority groups and the census? We hear that there could be an undercount as well for the African-American population.
Yeah, I think that there is that danger because undercounting is correlated with poverty, as your previous guest said. Mm-hmm. Right. I would say Asian Americans actually are very high risk for undercount. Like Latinos, Asian Americans are a much younger population. And so younger, poorer, right? And we sometimes think, Asian Americans are this really affluent group, but there are many subgroups like Hmong and Cambodian and other Southeast Asians who are actually quite poor have more children, et cetera, harder to count.
Laura, you head the UCLA Critical Race Studies Program. Can you explain critical race theory for us?
Yes. And I should say that along with my colleagues, I was a founder of the program also 20 years ago. We're celebrating our 20th anniversary all year. Critical race theory is the idea that racism is structurally rooted and is endemic to the United States. Endemic meaning that it is built into our history, kind of like what I was talking about with the three-fifths clause of the Constitution, right? And that we also have this phenomenon in the United States where we use the law to solve a problem, like the 14th Amendment after the Civil War, right? But then discrimination pops up in another place, right? It's sort of shape shifts, or it kind of, we press it down here, but it comes up over here. And I think that we're all actually more attuned to this after the summer that we've had because of the resistance to police violence. And just because people are talking a lot more about structural racism, institutional racism.
And there are some, if I understand this correctly, there are some theories that race itself was somewhat invented in the United States, the concept of race.
Yes, hence the title of my latest book, Inventing Latinos, A New Story of American Racism, right? So you're referring to something that we call the social construction of race, right? So it's the idea that you know, people are assigned to different races right now, but we actually don't have, there aren't actually differences within that. From one group to another, those differences are not meaningful, right? We have so much in common, right? But that doesn't mean that those differences don't have power because of the history that we have and because of the politics that we have, right? And so even though race is socially constructed, racism is real.
Yeah, I could just talk to you forever. Laura Gomez
likewise
is a professor of law and faculty director of UCLA's Critical Race Studies program. We really appreciate you taking the time to share your insight with us this morning. Thank you, Laura.
Enjoyed it. Bye-bye.
And still ahead, what a significant census undercount would mean for the next decade and how that count is faring under historically challenging conditions. Have you filled out your census survey yet, or have you not filled out your census survey yet? Why is that? Let us know. Use the Ask Insight hashtag on Twitter, or you can email us. We're insight@capradio.org. We'd love to hear your reasoning behind that. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. A federal judge ruled last week the U.S. Census count can continue through to the October 31st deadline due to the pandemic. But then yesterday, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross tweeted the 2020 census count will end early on October 5th, despite the ruling. Terri-Ann Lowenthal is a census expert and former staff director of the U.S. House of Representatives Census Oversight Subcommittee. Perfect person to talk to today about this. She told the Washington Post yesterday, the confusion over when counting operations will end is making it difficult to conduct the count. And much of this is undermining confidence in the results, even before there are any final numbers. Terri-Ann Lowenthal, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So what exactly does this kind of confusion, or I guess like constant change in messaging, have on the overall census count?
Well, the Census Bureau conducts the census nationally. It plans it. It carries it out. But the census is really a local operation in that there are hundreds of thousands of partner organizations, local officials, businesses, nonprofits, service agencies, and so forth, who are the trusted voices that convince people who are reluctant or fearful of the government and so forth, or just don't know what the census is, to participate, to fill out the census. And these organizations are continuing to work hard to promote self-response or to have people cooperate with the census taker who might be coming to the door as the census winds down. And so these constantly shifting end dates for responding online or by phone or for enumerators to go out in the field are making it very difficult for all of these trusted messengers, these trusted voices, to get a clear message out.
If you've ever been in a management position and you're trying to schedule workers, or if you are a worker who is frustrated by not knowing what your schedule is going to be, that can really create mayhem in trying to get things done.
I think it's not only the public that's confused. I've heard from quite a few enumerators directly or indirectly from across the country. I also serve on my state and my city complete count committee on the other side of the country. You're in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And The census field staff are saying that they're confused about when their work will wrap up, and that is never a good sign for a robust operation.
So, Terri-Ann, these numbers that are being collected, they're locked in for a decade, right?
That's correct. We have to live with the results for the next 10 years.
So let's talk about the short term and then, of course, the long term implications of a miscount.
Well, the census has many uses, many purposes. The very first one, of course, is enshrined in the Constitution. The census is literally the foundation, the cornerstone of our representative democracy. And so once the census is finished, a representation in the U.S. House of Representatives, as well as in the state legislatures, all the way down to city councils, county commissions, and school boards, will depend on census numbers. But equally important, census data are used to inform decision-making, policy-making, and the allocation of resources for all kinds of vital services. Crediting the George Washington University's Counting for Dollars 2020 census report, $1.5 trillion a year from the federal government is allocated, you know, directly or indirectly based on census numbers. So it's really important that we get the census right.
Somebody just sent us a message via Twitter. American B-Boy says that he filled out the census survey the day it arrived and thinks about the census as patriotic. It's sort of in the same category as voting. Do you see it that way?
I certainly do. The census is the federal government's very first responsibility in the U.S. Constitution. I also want to point out that it is a responsibility of Congress, not of the executive branch. Congress has delegated some of that authority to take a census to the Department of Commerce and the Census Bureau within that department. But the census is really the most fundamental civic activity because the allocation of political representation and then how much your vote counts all depends on the census in the first instance.
So, Terri-Ann, this question has made its way through the previous two guests, so I want to give you a chance to respond as well. What difference does one more month make in counting?
I think it makes a big difference, but it's only half the story. In terms of collecting data, the counting operations themselves, the Census Bureau has been stymied this year almost from the start, because the pandemic literally hit this census just as peak operations were getting off the ground last March. And so literally every census operation was disrupted, delayed, some were canceled in one way or another. And the Census Bureau now is doing the largest, most complex operation, the door-knocking operation, at the height of natural disaster season. We don't have to tell Californians about, you know, wildfires. And then it's also the height of hurricane season. And Gulf Coast and Southeast states really have lagging response rates at this point. But that's really only half the threat of a shortened census timeline. Because once data collection ends, the Census Bureau has to go through very complex series of data processing and quality assurance activities, which take about 5 months under a normal census timeline. But under this rushed timeline that the current administration, you know, kind of imposed on the Census Bureau back in early August, that really important work is now being compressed into 3 months or less, and all of the external watchdogs that are looking at this, the Inspector General and Government Accountability Office, you know, are sounding an alarm that the rush schedule for data processing is really putting an accurate census at risk.
When we look at the undercounted population, which is often in communities of color, how many people are we talking about not being included in the census data? Is there a way for us to understand that without the census numbers?
Well, there is historically. We don't know yet how many people have been counted when the Census Bureau talks about the percent of the count that it's completed. It generally is talking about the number of households, right? The number of housing units as a percent of the whole universe of housing units, of which the Census Bureau knows. We have to remember there are what we call hidden or low visibility housing units, right? Illegal basement apartments, or in a rural area, some, you know, a family living in a camper or a shed behind a rural home and so forth. And then we have to remember that there are people who don't live in households, people experiencing homelessness, significant problem in California, people in transitory locations and so forth. And so we don't know yet anything about the accuracy of this count, although we have some indicators, and I'm very worried that it will be significantly worse than in the past. But we do know from the Census Bureau's own scientific evaluations of past censuses that the census has missed millions and millions of people. It also has double counted millions more. So the census looks pretty accurate at the national level because these undercounts and overcounts kind of cancel each other out. The problem is that the people who are more likely to be missed historically, we know that, don't tend to live in the same communities as those who are more likely to be double counted. So rather than canceling each other out at the local level, these mistakes in the census, these, you know, misses and double counts, they compound each other. And so some communities are getting more than their fair share of political representation and public resources and even private investment, while those communities that are much more likely to be undercounted are not getting the political representation or resources that they not just deserve and to which they're entitled, but that they really need.
Terri-Ann, what would cause an overcount, and why would that more likely occur in one community over another?
Well, overcounting has been found more likely among homeowners, which is kind of a proxy for higher income households, and also among non-white non-Hispanic white populations. Generally, households that have more than one home, right? A second home, a vacation home, or more than two homes, snowbirds, for example, and the like. And then college students in particular who attend school and live away from home or even out of state. And so for this, the Census Bureau estimated that in the 2010 census, there were 8 million double counts, duplicates. For this census, I'm very worried that that number will be even much higher for two reasons. One is that many people who had a second home once the pandemic hit, kind of many of them escaped from cities and so forth, I use that term colloquially, to a second home in an area they thought, you know, was hit less by the coronavirus, and then college students. And this is a significant issue for California. The pandemic hit at the end of March, early April. College students are supposed to be counted at their school-based residence, whether they live on campus in a group facility such as a dorm or off campus in private housing, you know, in the surrounding neighborhoods. But once the pandemic hit, many, if not most, college students around the country, you know, except for those in community college, of course, went home. And that was often to a completely different part of the state or often in another state. And so their parents may have thought, well, they're home, I better count them now, which is incorrect.
Uh-huh.
And so trying to address the significant displacement of population where they should have been counted as of last April 1st is a continuing challenge for the Census Bureau. And that's why having enough time for the data processing, which sounds so boring, but it's really critical because that's where they do the unduplication. Why compressing that timetable, you know, as well as the counting schedule, really could put the accuracy of this census at risk.
So we have a little less than a minute left. The administration, the Trump administration, says the Bureau has counted nearly 99% of households and can produce a complete and accurate census by the end of the year. Do you think that's accurate?
I don't, and here's why. The percent of housing units counted by itself tells us little to nothing about the quality and accuracy of the data they have collected. I mentioned before that there are many people who don't even live in households, right? But also these completed cases could have been done by talking to a neighbor or a landlord. The Census Bureau will be using more administrative records to fill in the blanks. And by rushing, these enumerators may not have time, is what we're hearing, to really collect all of the important data, not just about how many people, but a little bit about their characteristics, which is vital for informed and sound policy making and implementation of the Voting Rights Act going forward.
Well, if you couldn't tell, Terri-Ann Lowenthal is a census expert, to be sure. I feel like I know the census way better than I have in the past. Former staff director of the U.S. House of Representatives Census Oversight Subcommittee. Terri-Ann, thank you so much for giving us some of your time this morning. We really appreciate it.
You are welcome. Thanks for having me.
And as always, find out more about any of the guests you heard from today here on Insight. You know, daily we tweet out contacts for the guests that we have on, a link to the Insight podcast and webpage, and a preview for the next day's show, sometimes asking for your input. So follow us. We're at Cap Radio Insight. I'm specifically at Randall White, and that's with an O-L in the Randall. Don't forget, debate tonight. You can listen or watch at capradio.org. That is Insight for today. We will have a debate wrap-up tomorrow. We will listen to you or listen to us then.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.